This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, October 21st, the Norris Group proudly presents its 9th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Christopher is the director of the UC Riverside School of Business Administration, Center for Economic Forecasting and Development, and the founding partner of Beacon Economics. Christopher, thanks for joining us again. And we've talked many times, and last year I was part of a pretty great conference, and you've got that coming up again on the September 29th. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So September 29th, we're going to be doing our next UC Riverside Forecast Conference. We're real excited about it. This one's called the Inland Empire 2035. And besides, of course, the standard outlook for the local economy, state economy, national economy, we're also going to be talking about what the IE looks like 20 years from now. You know, it's going to be over a million new people out there, and that means that there's got to be a lot of policy decisions put into place today regarding health, transportation, and education. So we're going to get some experts in from across the region talking about what those plans are and what needs to be accomplished. This is a big place. It's one of the most rapidly growing places, and making that good growth means understanding those kind of important aspects of it.
Well, Christopher, we look forward to it. I'll be in the audience.
I look forward to seeing you there, Bruce.
A lot of things going on. I look at charts. You know, I kind of I like looking at charts, and I'm looking at about 4.8% unemployment rate for the nation. That used to mean pretty much full employment, and yet it's matched with a 1% GDP growth for the first half of the year. So what do you make of those two numbers coinciding?
Well, the GDP number is always a little bit tricky. We have to remember that that's kind of a measure of increases in real gross output. But as I always like to tell folks, it's not output you should be focusing on, but rather demand. So output in the first part of the year was quite weak, but a lot of that had to do with trade and inventories and issues with the ongoing, shall we say, implosion of the oil exploration market. But when you take a step back and you look at core demand, particularly demand from consumers and government, well, the numbers there are much better. And indeed, overall growth in demand in the first half of the year was running close to 2%. And there's no reason to think that demand's going to go away anytime in the near future. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that I think the 1% is more reflective of external problems, while internally we continue to chug along, and I expect that means that growth is going to be much better in the second half of the year.
Okay. 10-year T-bill at about 1.5%. What is that telling us?
Well, it goes back again to some of these external issues we've been dealing with. Like, you know, it's funny. We live in a world right now where there's all sorts of things going on. We have really that crazy instability in the Middle East. We have issues, of course, with the commodity glut and the problem that's creating for economies from Venezuela to Russia. We have the issues with the Brexit, and obviously we have a slowing Chinese economy. I mean, you go through the litany of problems in the rest of the world, and as big isn't as powerful and as relatively insulated as the U.S. is from these kind of global trends, nevertheless, some of this is going to spill into our shores in positive and negative ways. The negative ways is the fact that exports, for example, have not been doing very well, and the dollar has gone up a bit, and that puts U.S. exporters in a worse position, makes our economy a little less desirable. On the other hand, when you think about it from a commodity price effect, low oil prices, low steel prices, these are great for the U.S. economy, and equivalently, you look at people across the globe buying U.S. treasuries, mainly because we're a shining star in these turbulent times, and people want to put their money here as a safe place, and that safe haven means interest rates are nice and low. These are good things for the U.S. economy, and ultimately I think that they'll more than outweigh the negative shocks, and again, our U.S. economy will continue to move forward.
You've got about 40% of the world's sovereign's debt in negative yield territory, and you kind of express that chases maybe buyers into our sovereign debt. But what is that telling us, that the negative interest rates returns that are across the globe in a lot of countries, what is that telling us about their economy?
Well, you got to be really careful, because it is true that the European Central Bank, for example, and Japan as well, they have been playing around with negative interest rates. But that's within the banking system. For example, in the European Union, it's not so much that a 10-year bond, a German 10-year bond, for example, is a negative territory. It's very low, but it's not a negative territory. They are charging negative interest rates to holdings of banks at the central bank, the European Central Bank, in this particular situation. What this tells us is that there is a lot of deflationary pressures. Now, we live in a world that has two things going on simultaneously. We have the deflationary pressures coming from some of this global turmoil we were just talking about. We also have a situation where we are in a relatively low interest rate world. Now, that's a problem for central banks, because central banks can no longer use traditional policies, that is, say, manipulating what we call the federal funds rate or the interbank lending rate, in order to try and push more money in the economy to fight off the deflationary problems. To deal with this, they have to use secondary methods of pumping liquidity into the overall economy. Namely, the second sort of line of defense is what we've been calling quantitative easing, what our Federal Reserve has used with quite some success. Now, quantitative easing works on by basically buying bonds from banks, and then banks, in theory, are supposed to take that liquidity and push it into the economy through more loan volume. The problem they're having in Europe is they keep buying the bonds, but banks aren't putting the money into the economy into loans. Rather, the banks are sticking it into excess reserves. The idea of negative interest rates is to encourage the banks, if you will, to take that money and indeed lend it out to people to get it into the economy. So it's a natural reaction to that problem. Now, mind you, this may not be working, and at some point in time, I wouldn't doubt for a second that they may say, well, negative interest rates aren't really getting us what we need. Perhaps the next step, the next idea, would be to do more direct cash infusions into the economy. Indeed, Ben Bernanke back in the day was called a helicopter Ben, because he said that the third stage, if you can't get QE to work because the banks are hanging on all the cash, you just start flying helicopters around and throwing $100 bills out of the helicopters, as he's called helicopter Ben.
Right.
Now, that's kind of facetious. You're not going to do that. But in Europe, for example, the European Central Bank could simply send a 300 euro check to every single person who lives in the European Union. That would be a way of getting money into the economy and to try and fight off deflation.
Why is inflation preferable over deflation?
Well, in a deflationary era, you have a big problem with the negative interest rates. We've already talked about that. Like, if a bank is going to charge you, is actually going to charge you for leaving money in the bank, your actual best investment is to take your money out of the bank and leave it in hard cash under your mattress. Well, that's really destabilizing to a monetary system which relies on what we call the money multiplier that banks fulfill. in terms of creating liquidity. It could create a lot of problems within the system. So a little bit of inflation fights that off. Most economists agree 2 to 3% is a nice comfortable range. The problem in Europe is we're running like 0.5%. And indeed, here in the United States, we're not much more than that. We're running between 1 and 1.5%. So you got to get the money in the system and keep things moving forward.
Has Japan implemented helicopter money?
Not yet. They are still in the midst of quantitative easing. We'll see how that pans out. So, again, it's primarily a deflationary problem in Japan, like many other places. Now, of course, Japan has other issues, and indeed, one of the things about Japan that's been a big disappointment is they've been very good at applying monetary stimulus. But we have to remember that monetary stimulus is at best a short run solution. Ultimately, many of the problems, say, for example, in Japan, are going to occur through deregulation. And on that front, Japan's been much less successful.
They also have demographic issues. So I guess
that as well, yes.
What they've experienced over the last 20 years, are we going to have a similar path but a milder one?
No, I don't think so. Look, Japan's population has peaked and is already starting to decline, and the number of working-age folks is in full decline. The United States, we don't have that issue. Our workforce is still growing, albeit at a slower pace, but we're still growing our economy. I mean, Japan would do themselves a huge favor if they would allow immigration, but they've been remarkably unwilling to allow that. I do find it intriguing here in the United States, the vitriol sort of shown towards immigrants by various groups. And yet, on the other hand, I would point out that immigration has been, I think, an enormous benefit to the United States economy from a short-term and a long-term standpoint. We have to keep in mind that if we want to keep our economy stable in the long run, we're going to have new workers to step in and fill the holes that are going to be vacated as the boomers start to move out.
Do you see California's economy doing better than the United States?
Oh, absolutely. You know, California right now, it continues to be in the top 10 from an overall growth rate over the course of the last couple of years. Equivalently, we are adding, from an absolute perspective, more jobs than anybody else. Now, we're a big economy, but to put that in context, from an absolute perspective, we've added more jobs than Texas and Florida put together over the last year. Pretty impressive numbers when you think about it. It is an economy doing great. Now, not all parts of the California economy are doing well. Some sectors do continue to suffer. We have high energy costs, and candidly, some of our environmental regulations are problematic for certain industries. Light industry, for example, particularly in food, things like that are moving out. You're seeing apparel continue to struggle. But putting these sort of exceptions to one side, the vast majority of the California economy is doing very well right now.
What's holding back single-family construction? I hear California Association of Realtors talk about they're really 100,000 short of where they should be, something in that range. Do you agree with that statement, that we're building far fewer homes than really we have demand for?
Yes, but we got to be very careful because there's two parts. Again, you start scratching away at these things, and that's a little simplistic. Look, there's two major issues going on in housing right now. There's what we call the California-centric issues, and then there's the global issues. Globally, across the United States, we continue to see the single-family, particularly the single-family purchase market, really underperform. Overall, new home sales are running 600,000. They could and should easily be close to a million at this particular point in time. Why such a problem there? Well, it's been a combination of things. There's been this excess supply of single family left over from the big bubble. We obviously have seen a very slow recovery. Most problematic has been the fact that these new rules, this Dodd-Frank set of rules, which try to push the liability of any kind of mortgage problem from the borrower onto the lender, has pushed a tremendous amount of people out of the potential buy pool, as the case may be. You know, 15 years ago, the median credit score for somebody getting a new mortgage loan was about 700. Today it's 750. Doesn't sound like a big shift, but that would exclude 15, almost 20% of the U.S. population, and that's exactly about the number of people who are not getting back in the single family the way they should. Now, the situation is getting better. It's getting better because people's incomes are rising, because their credit is getting cleaned up. We have a situation, and people's equity in their home is rebuilt, and that's what's pushed the new home sales up some, and I expect that to continue to change in the future. But unless they change these mortgage rules, it's going to continue to be a slow, underwhelming housing recovery, and that's just a problem here. It's a problem in Ohio. It's a problem in Alabama. That's just the nature of the beast. Now, here in California, we just have a housing shortage. And, of course, that housing shortage is driven by the ferocity of NIMBYism we see within the California economy. And Lord knows that's not changing at all.
What is that, NIMBYism?
NIMBYism, not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard,
you know,
okay.
Yeah, not in my backyard. Just think of the vast number of CEQA lawsuits that are constantly being filed, how people fight tooth and nail against any kind of new development, particularly against densification, which is too bad. Look, this state needs housing. And I say housing because I'm not going to be particularly fussed whether it's single family, multifamily, for sale, or for rent. The single largest problem we have in the state of California is lack of housing, driven by our own bad ideas when it comes to allowing housing development. So, sadly, no one seems to want to respond to this except for to create programs to subsidize affordable housing. I like to say we don't have an affordable housing crisis. We have a housing crisis. And the difference is very simple. Affordable housing advocates, for the most part, want to tax the creation of regular housing to subsidize the creation of affordable housing. But guess what? That just makes the non-affordable housing market that much less affordable and that much more undersupplied. So in a sense, you can't do this. You got to take a step back and look at the root causes. NIMBYism, CEQA, Prop 13, I can go through a litany of problems that no one just wants to stand up and say, hey, here, we got to fix these.
When we're talking about affordable housing units, are we talking about like entire inventories of them in one location, or are we talking about when a builder builds a tract of houses, he has to have a certain percentage of them become a different price range and people have to have certain circumstances to access the inventory? Just curious. One I think would be really bad for the future in the sense that you could have really problem areas emerge from that idea. If they were scattered in a normal track, then I think that would be better if there is a better.
If there is a better, right? I mean, there's all sorts of ways of I don't, you know. For me, you're kind of going at picking at some of the smaller issues, but for me, we have to have a really top-down conversation about this, and I say top-down because one of the big problems is you just have some cities that absolutely refuse to, if you will, do their fair share of home building, right?
Okay.
I mean, there's just cities on the outside who just, I'm not going to do this, you know, and then that's it. Somehow or other, the state has to tell local jurisdictions that you have to densify, you have to build more units, but of course they're very loath to do that.
Okay. The election. I'm just curious. Not saying pick a winner, but if Clinton wins, what effect on the economy?
Well, listen, I appreciate that we're not supposed to. If Clinton wins, not much is going to change.
Okay.
Because it's pretty clear that there's going to be a partial, if you will, Republican reduction in Republican majorities. Potentially, they might lose their majority in the Senate altogether. But they will almost assuredly maintain the majority in the Congress. And so with that in mind, you say, well, you know, what's going to change? And the answer is really not much, because you still have this radical group of Tea Partiers in the Congress who will simply not deal in any substantial way with a Democratic president. So whether it's Obama or whether it's Hillary, it ends up being largely irrelevant, as the case may be.
What do you think of fiscal debt levels, let's say, if you had an 8-year or 10 presidency of Clinton?
I don't think it's relevant.
Really?
To be perfectly honest with you.
Okay.
Well, two things. First of all, remember, the president does not create the budget. Congress does. That's not within the president's purview or power. It's not in their power. So I always laugh, for example, when the presidential candidates have to stand up and present their quote-unquote economic plan, because the vast majority of economic plans has to do with taxing and spending, which is not what they do anyway. That's what Congress does, and the president, they can create a laundry list of what they would like. They can certainly veto certain elements of things, but for the most part, this is what Congress does, not what the president does. And so what ends up happening is it just becomes a game where Trump comes up with a plan that more or less is designed to mollify the Republican base, and Clinton comes up with a spending plan designed to mollify the Democratic base. But both parties understand that these plans aren't worth the paper they're written on, because it all depends on Congress. So, but that's the first part of it. Second part of it is the fiscal debt is not relevant. Look, we have a net debt, net federal debt. And when I say net, you got to net out the 40% of that debt, which is held by the federal government itself. We have a net federal debt of like 60% of GDP. The interest rate burden today is lower than under the Reagan administration. We do have more debt, but interest rates are so much lower, it doesn't matter.
Well, isn't that a good formula? If you were going to increase debt, wouldn't that be, like, is that a blueprint going forward saying, okay, we can have $30 trillion of debt, we just have to have a lower interest rate, and it's a moot point?
Well, that's absolutely fine. We certainly could do that. But I think my point is that it's not the funded liabilities that are the issue right now. It's the unfunded liabilities.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's to me. So, I'm glad you kind of came here, because for all the differences between Clinton and Trump, right? And boy, I mean, you can't go through the differences: the ultimate outsider versus the ultimate insider, the consummate politician compared to the consummate anti-politician, the populism versus the whatever. We can go through the list. We all know how incredibly different these two individuals are. Yet, take a step back and look at the similarities. Here's one massive similarity: neither one of them are talking about the kind of substantial changes to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid necessary to make these things actually sustainable in the long run. We're 15 years out from the boomers getting deep into retirement, when the support ratio is going to go from 3.5 to about 2-1. And when I say support ratio, I mean worker to retiree.
Yeah, the math doesn't work.
We got to do this. We got to do it now. And nobody in this campaign is even talking about it. So to me, it's amazing. It's amazing just how sad and sorry a situation this is.
With that, I've got to end our show. As always, it's gone too quick. Christopher Thornburg, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Bruce, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks again.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Auction.com, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA Green Designs, LA South RIA, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Orange County Building Industry Association, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Realty Executives Inland Empire, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, U Direct IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Wholesale Capital Corporation, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.